This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to By the Book. I am Lee Chui Lin, and I'm joined as always by my co-host and co-conspirator, Sharmila Ganesan.
Hello.
And I'm using that word advisedly because today we are going to do a two-person book club. Usually we have someone in here, but today this was a big book and we have a lot of thoughts, So we thought we'd be fine on our own. And we're talking about Margaret Atwood's The Testaments.
Yep. Kind of a good book to wrap the year up with in terms of book club, because it was probably one of the most anticipated releases of this year. It's basically the sequel to one of the most, am I overselling it to say, significant books of the last few decades?
And I think a book that has actually gained in significance over the last couple of years. So that's helped it a lot. And it also co-won the Booker Prize this year.
It did. Well, The Testaments did.
Yes. Not Handmaid's Tale. No, not 25 years after the fact. The Testaments co-won it. It was a joint awarding to Margaret Atwood as well as Bernardine Evaristo, who won for Girl, Woman, Other.
This is The Handmaid's Tale. It was published in 1985. And this is where we last saw Offred in the book. The van waits in the driveway, its double doors stand open. The two of them, one on either side now, take me by the elbows to help me in. Whether this is my end or a new beginning, I have no way of knowing. I have given myself over into the hands of strangers because it can't be helped. And so I step up into the darkness within, or else the light. Well, no spoilers, but we will learn enough to know that it was more like the light than the darkness.
Were you excited when you heard that Margaret Atwood was writing a sequel to Handmaid's Tale?
Yes and no. I have I think by now pretty well documented fear of sequels. I am anxious about them. I worry that they won't live up to my expectations. I worry that they won't live up to the original work. Will it sully the original work? So I had some concerns. Were you excited?
I was because, okay, now this is going to sound weird. I was actually excited. And then the book didn't turn out to be what I thought it would be.
Right.
So I actually thought it would either be a completely different story set within the same universe, or that it would take place much, much later. And neither of those things were true. And that sort of disappointed me a little bit.
So if you've somehow managed to miss any part of Handmaid's Tale, any part of discussion about Margaret Atwood and anything like that, then I will say that I don't think you should read this book without reading Handmaid's Tale.
No, I don't think, I'll go so far on a limb as to say that there's no reason to read this book if you haven't read The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So for the purposes of our show then, Handmaid's Tale takes place in a sort of near future in which the United States government is overthrown by a theocracy, right? And they call themselves Gilead. They establish
their own state, basically.
Yes, within the United States. And in it, women are stripped of pretty much every right you could imagine. There is no reading and writing. You do not own property. And you fall within very strict categories of where you are allowed to exist.
It's also a future where fertility rates have dropped tremendously. So the woman's ability to bear children becomes paramount. And so the society kind of puts that functionality of the woman's body above almost every other reason she might have to exist.
Correct. It's either that or be sinless.
Yes.
So you've got your wives who are what they sound like. You have your handmaids who are the fertile women who were sinners in their past lives and therefore have now been consigned, conscripted to go on assignments to people's houses and go through a ritual, a monthly ritual in the hopes that they get pregnant.
Yes. So the reason this story, I think, has become, as you mentioned, so much more significant in the last few years is since the Trump election and since a lot of the overturning of pro-women laws in the US. I'm not going to say a lot, but particularly the abortion laws, which are currently sort of hugely debated in the US.
This outfit that the handmaids are made to wear has become a symbol of the women's movement in the United States. What do you think about that?
Well, it started in Texas.
It started in Texas? Yeah.
There was a moment when a lot of men in dark states were going to sign into law legislation restricting women's bodies again.
Again?
Again. So these women decided that they would put on the handmaid's outfit and go and just sit in the legislature. As a protest, it's quite brilliant because nobody can kick you out for creating a disturbance. Nobody can kick you out for dressing immodestly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But everybody looking at it knows what it means.
And also because of the TV show. We can't deny that. The TV show came out and the first season for me was brilliant. So there's been a resurgence of interest in this particular book.
So that's where we left Handmaid's Tale, which is a pretty harrowing but also quite action-packed read in many ways. It's quite thrilling. There's a lot of suspense. There's also a decent amount, there's a really good amount of fleshing out of Gilead. You know, you understand the workings of society. And then we come to the Testaments. So you do need to know all that because otherwise this book makes no sense at all. So The Testaments, I guess, picks up, how many years would you say, about 20 years? Maybe less.
I'd say maybe 15 to 18 years, perhaps. Mm. Yeah, given the characters that we're introduced to.
Yes. Yeah. So it picks up after Handmaid's Tale, which ends on something of a cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. And, we forgot to say, another important thing to say about Handmaid's Tale before we proceed, because it's significant for The Testaments, is that The Handmaid's Tale... So they're actually one woman's accounts of, you know, her life as a handmaid. And then what's happened is that you find this out at the end of the book at a historical forum many years later.
Many years in the future, someone sort of excavated these accounts and they're kind of used to rebuild and to get an understanding of the Gilead years and what that community was like. So we kind of learn at the end of the first book that Gilead has fallen, and that this was in the past. And it was sort of one of those civilizations that existed and has now ended.
But we also learned that the story that we've just read is not super reliable because this was one person's story. There might be pseudonyms involved. And also it's one person's story as told through someone else. Mm-hmm. And that structure is an important thing to keep in mind when you read the Testaments.
Yeah. So for me, right, that I think is a great sort of segue into talking about why the Testaments didn't feel as powerful for me. Because when you're reading The Handmaid's Tale, you don't know that that's what you're reading until the end, right? And then you're kind of like, oh, wow, so this was a one person's point of view. This was a version of history. Whereas with Testaments, it's structured as that, right?
Every chapter
is account of this person, account of that person. And that somehow took away some of the power of the original story.
Right. I think it's also the fact that this is not a one woman story anymore. Instead, it is a story of three particular characters, one whom you know, and the other two who are new.
Yes.
And so I like that. I didn't really enjoy the ordering of the stories, but I very much enjoyed the fact that we were in Gilead and out of Gilead with different characters. So I think what you lose is you lose the general sense of oppression, the oppressive, repressive, you know, permeating quality of Gilead that ran through Offred's tale in The Handmaid's Tale. Because essentially with that, you have one person who's just struggling to make sense of it, escape, and can't. In this case, you have a society that's now some decades old and kind of you're right in it. Mm-hmm. So I appreciated that. I appreciated the different points of view. I liked that there were also very specific insights into some characters that you didn't get in the first go round.
This book, it has three narrators, all of them female. What is it like to grow up as a young woman within Gilead once Gilead is already established? And what is it like to grow up across the border in Canada with Gilead an ever-present threat and also a missionary presence because, of course, Gilead would send missionaries and also spies? And what would it be to be an older woman in a position of considerable secret power within Gilead? And the other question is, since we know Gilead disappeared, what brought it down?
So I really liked the world expanding, I'm going to call it, because the world was already built in the first book. But it really does do a great job of expanding the politics of how this society works, who holds the power and how tenuous that can be, and even the history of how this was built. Because in the first book, there's a bit of a gap between, yes, people were living these average American lives, and then suddenly there was Gilead. We kind of hear how that happened, but here you get a lot of the details of how people were convinced and conscripted into the system. And that was really well done.
Conscripted is an important word because there are some glimpses or some deep dives, in fact, into why somebody who fundamentally might not believe in Gilead's principles might still make the choice to become one of its most powerful people. And once you're there, how hard will you fight to keep that power?
Right.
Or how hard will you fight to maintain or destroy that structure that you're a part of? And you can't really get that when the story is being told from the point of view of the utterly powerless. Mm. There is value in that story. Of course there is. I mean, Handmaid's Tale is a classic for a reason. But there is also a real sense of perspective that you gain when you can actually see what's happening on the side of the powerful.
I don't know. I felt like there was... I wasn't connecting emotionally to much of the story, not in the way that I connected to Handmaid's Tale. Handmaid's Tale, for me, immediately from the moment you realize what you're reading, you're so emotionally invested and you're so caught up, and every new revelation felt like a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
This felt like it almost felt like I was reading literally that, a book that expands a world. It's like a history book of Gilead almost, where I'm getting the facts, they're interesting. Doesn't resonate emotionally with me.
Okay, so I have some thoughts to offer to that, but we are going to be taking a bit of a break. Do you like Margaret Atwood's works? And in particular, have you read Handmaid's Tale? Have you read The Testaments? Were you excited for it? Tell us all your thoughts. We want to know. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila, and today it's our book club episode, a big one to kind of wind down the year. And we're talking about, really, I think, one of the most highly anticipated books that was published this year, Margaret Atwood's The Testaments, a follow-up to her critical and best-selling hit, you know, The Handmaid's Tale. So you said earlier that emotion was kind of a problem.
Yeah, for me, connecting emotionally.
I completely get that, but I kind of didn't need it because this is going to sound disparaging, but I don't mean it that way. This book is like Mission Impossible in Handmaid's Tale land. Do you know what I mean? and that is, I think it's an important thing to state up front, because if you, like me, have read Handmaid's Tale, have watched all of it, I have to steel myself very often to sit down and sit through Handmaid's Tale, despite the fact that it's, I think, a fantastic show. It's well acted, it's well directed. Great. But it's hard.
Oh, it's hard, yeah.
Testaments is not hard. And, you know, that lack of emotional connection that you're talking about, I think is actually a strength, because it means that I can kind of engage with it with a little less dread than I normally feel when I approach these books and this world.
Maybe I wanted the dread, you know?
Sure.
And I don't mean that in a flippant way. Mm. I think I wanted that... I read Handmaid's Tale as an adult, right? I wasn't very... I only read it, I think, a few years ago. And so for me, a lot of it felt very immediate. And I kind of wanted Testaments to say something new.
Right.
To expand on the emotions on the first one. And I felt like it didn't. I felt like it was a good companion piece. It was... I would read it again if I didn't have much else to do, perhaps. But if I didn't, I wouldn't also feel like it was a huge loss, which I'm surprised, because I would read as difficult a read as it is, and I would have to steel myself to do it, I would read Handmaid's Tale again because I feel like there's value in it.
I think the word that's coming to mind through all of this is compelling. I think The Testaments is compelling, but it's not compelling for the reasons we wanted it to be, perhaps, or it's not significant. And I think that's maybe also something that just happens where with Handmaid's Tale, it was predictive. There were a lot of things that she wrote about where we were like, we must never let this happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why there was such an immediate connection to 2016, 2017, because it's like, well, it's happening. With the Testaments, it's almost like it's a foregone conclusion, which is a dark thing to say, but it feels like, well, yeah, this is totally where things could go.
If I had thought, let's write a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale of this kind in 1999, I would have said, why bother? We're not going there. Surely people are moving away from that. Mm. But in the moment in which we now exist, that's not true anymore.
So in 1999, you would have said, why bother?
Yes.
But in 2016, 17...
I'm going to bother. It's time to bother. You can't ignore the fact that there are a number of regimes that have come into power that have these kinds of ideas in mind. The thing they have in common is they all want to roll back women's rights.
But also, in a weird way, right, the fact that she actually opts for a, well, I hope I'm not giving too much away, but essentially what is quite a happy ending feels like, again, am I sounding too grinchy here? I'm not sure. Feels like a cop-out. It's not that I want everything to be doom and gloom, but it feels too easy almost. It's like that ending doesn't feel earned after everything that was built in Handmaid's Tale and then even expanded upon in Testaments. The way all of it finally sort of ends up seems too convenient, almost like fan service.
It's Mission Impossible. That's what I'm
saying.
Now
that I'm thinking about it that way, I feel like I can accept it a little bit more.
Yeah, because it's quite clear to me in that point, you know, because there's sort of there's some ludicrous planning and heisting that goes on in this book. And like you said, the ending is a little bit too, and they were all fine on Christmas morning. Mm-hmm. You know, it has that quality to it. I completely agree.
But do we give Mission Impossible's the Oscar? You know, like they've given this the Booker Prize.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with her name, right? So coming into this, I think I knew that there was something that I wanted to bring up, which was, I don't know how to talk about Margaret Atwood without talking about Margaret Atwood's everything. Mm-hmm. Because, I suppose, you know, with our book clubs, we don't only talk about the book, but with something like The Testaments, it's very difficult to talk about it without talking about everything surrounding it. The TV show, President Trump, America, you know, the Booker. It's just all these different things inform our experience and expectation of the book. Before we get to that, I will just say that I really like the fact that we were seeing the first generation of Gilead women, meaning women who knew no other world. And that was fascinating
that
to me.
That was actually one of my favorite parts about this book. And I kind of wish, so you mentioned earlier that there were three characters, right? And one that we know, one who's new and who kind of lives outside of Gilead. And the third is the character that is basically the first generation of women. She's born there. I kind of wish that we just had that, because I feel like that third character from outside, completely superfluous, really bogged the story down, could have cut the novel down by one third and not missed much.
So we've had chats about this. We basically hate one third of the book. I think that part of that is because one of the book's three characters is insufferable.
Yes.
It's not great,
and
you know?
So poorly written that I'm shocked. Like, if you handed me excerpts of just her scenes, I would be like, this is Margaret Atwood. It reads like a really bad YA romance.
But then the other two characters are so strong. I mean, so there's one whom you already know, but to kind of hear a different side of her story, it's debatable whether you needed to know it. But now that I know it, I like it. I like the fact that I know it. And that was so well written. And the voice of that character was so strong and so idiosyncratic that it just worked, right? And then you have a whole other character who is this person who's just born into it. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know how to read or write. She is fully indoctrinated into the religion and the government of Gilead. And she sees no reason. Well, in her gut, she feels that it's not right. But her head is a totally different ballgame.
And so it's a very natural, it's a very natural and very believable character for someone who's kind of struggling with the two halves of, well, this is what I think is right, but this is what feels right. And that's exactly why she's so compelling.
One third of the book. But the other two thirds are, I think, worth a read. I get where you're coming from with the disappointment. But like I said, I went in and I was surprised by, gosh, I mean, if this weren't set where it was set, you could even use the word rollicking. You know, you would use the word romp. It just kind of rolls through. It's quick.
It's so easily readable.
Yeah. Don't be deceived by the size, right? And if not for the fact that it's in Gilead where everything's just gone to hell, really, it would be a super easy read. So I appreciate it for that. And I guess I'm judging it completely free of the booker. If I think about the booker, then yes, I get bogged down with, are you serious? Are you kidding me? Did it need it? But if I just take it on its own merits, I'm fine with it.
I would say that if you read The Handmaid's Tale and if you really liked it, or even if you kind of enjoyed it and thought it was interesting, that it's definitely worth reading this. Because unlike, say, Go Set a Watchman, which was the Mockingbird sequel, which to me felt utterly pointless and I'm like, don't read it, it will ruin the first book for you. This one is really, like, I think the best thing I would call it is a companion piece. It expands on the world, allows you to revisit it in a new way. Isn't too difficult to read, so it doesn't feel like it bogs you down too much. Will you lose too much by not reading it? No. But I think it's, in my opinion anyway, but I think it's a fun enough read that you could.
Honestly, I think if this directs people to Handmaid's Tale, that's a good thing. That's a job well done. Mm. You know, if you want to engage with the Testaments, and because you want to engage with the Testaments, you go back and read The Handmaid's Tale, then I think that it's all kind of worked out
for
the best.
That's how it should be, I think.
although, let's just kind of spend a little bit of time talking about that idea of the booker, right? Mm. Do you think that it won because of the zeitgeist? Because I think a lot of it has to do with that.
I think it does. And I think that's why it won. And also, I feel like that's why this whole Thai situation happened, right? Because they voted and they kept saying that they don't award the booker to winners and then nobody budged. I kind of feel like it's almost like they desperately wanted to give it to Margaret Atwood and nobody could kind of admit that her book wasn't that deserving of it. I feel so sacrilegious saying it because I really do like her writing. Mm. But even writing-wise, I don't think this was her strongest.
No. Although it made a little more sense to me about that term that has often been attached to her work that she has attached herself, that she's gotten a lot of criticism for, and that is speculative fiction. Yeah. Because I actually think that some of her other books, it's quite clear she's, to me at least, that she's dabbling with some of the tropes of sci-fi. Although I understand her distinction is that science fiction is based on things that have not yet and are very far away from happening, whereas speculative fiction is grounded in it's already sort of happening and it has happened. You know, there are moments in history.
I feel like she's leaving herself a loophole, but okay.
So if you think of a line that descends from Jules Verne in the 19th century, who was writing about submarines and big balloons. And then from Jules Verne, we have Brave New World. We have 1984. We have Fahrenheit 451. That's the family of stories to which Handmaid's Tale and The Testaments belong.
With The Testaments, I would give it the tag speculative fiction. Mm. I think it's quite hard to call it science fiction because it's not based on that, you know?
No, it's
actually based on something that she's looking, sort of forecasting and saying, based on this, well. Yeah, so that's how it feels for me. So at the very least, I don't always agree with that tag attached to her, but for this, yeah, why not?
I think for what it's worth, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to call it literary fiction or speculative fiction, if this being one of the biggest books of the year, I would have expected it to be better.
Mm.
But read it, I think, would be my final thought.
I say definitely read it. I think it was an exciting, good book. It was good. It wasn't great. I think that's really kind of where we've been struggling with. We wanted it to be great. It wasn't. I've comforted myself with the whole Ethan Hunt face shift thing. And that's been helping me through
it. The thing they put on book jackets. Good, but not great.
Good, but not great. The Mission Impossible of Gilead. So let us know. Have you read The Testaments? Are you planning to? Have you read Handmaid's Tale? Do you want to talk about it? Please do. We love hearing from you. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. And that brings us us to footnotes. And since we do always exhort people to like write us, you know, get in touch. And we don't always find the time in our show to respond. It is another one of our dedicated correspondence bits.
Our correspondence footnotes. Yeah, yeah. I love these.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can start off with one of the shows that got quite a number of responses, actually, is the one where we talked about introducing children to reading.
Mm.
And we had a WhatsApp come in from Benji who says, I suppose we can brainwash or condition kids to a certain degree for very young children about what to read. But after they've set on about what they like or don't like, it's quite difficult to change their minds. Then he says, my manly guy friends were all into gaming, adventure, etc. kind of books. Girls were all into mystery or cute stuff. I was never into fiction. Not that it's a waste of time, but it's just uninteresting. Often preferring books about dinosaurs or outer space.
Fair enough. And I think that one of the things about interests is that it might be set, but it will change, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think, or rather, it will develop.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about what I was interested in purple and unicorns. I was really that girl. And now I could not be further from that. You know, so
I still like purple, but
yeah,
unicorns aren't so much.
Yeah, I'm not like immediately drawn to a book about unicorns unless there's something else attached to it. And that also faded out pretty quickly when I got to my tween years. So I do think that while, you know, kids have passions, and I don't want to downplay that, they do shift and develop. And my reading patterns and habits certainly did. Okay, so we have another message here from York, who says, did any of you read Shel Silverstein as kids? The missing piece really stuck with me growing up, and his books have aged really well.
The missing piece sat alone, waiting for someone to come along and take it somewhere. Some fit, but could not roll. Others could roll, but did not fit. One didn't know a thing.
Kelvin and Hobbes also gave me an early existential experience, and the Far Side Gallery, not exactly books, but they subtly introduced adult concepts to me as a kid.
Mm. And Marina also sent in an email to say, I have two kids, 12 and 7. I have introduced them to reading at a very young age. They read almost every night before going to bed, and they're offline children. They prefer to read rather than being online.
How did you do that?
So she's also got a couple of books that they have read. She said her 12-year-old finished the Harry Potter series last year, and her 7-year-old son just finished his first Roald Dahl book, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
So I think that entire list of books, right? Roald Dahl, Harry Potter, Shel Silverstein, mm-hmm. Kelvin and Hobbes, Far Side Gallery, all fantastic. Could not yeah. recommend them enough. And also Kelvin and Hobbes introduced me to John Calvin and Thomas Hobbes. You know, because I wondered where the names yeah. came from, and then you look it up and you're like, whoa. So there is that. Elin says, conversely to Marina, Elin says, my son stopped reading when he started getting interested in video games in his later primary school years. So I got him graphic novels in the hopes that he wouldn't stop reading. And to my wonderful surprise, he started asking me to buy teenage flicks later on. I guess any kind of reading material is good as long as they are still reading.
If you do like hearing about the kinds of books that children can read or how to introduce kids to reading, you can also check out a show that we did with two children's experts, Daphne Lee and Sharifa Osman. We chatted about children's books and basically what's happening in children's literature now.
That's right. And we also had an entirely kind of separate tangent, right? We received an email, actually. Like I said, we love getting emails. We received an email from Ying Xiong, who wrote us sort of a series of thoughts about Sandman, about being passionate about books, but also had one recommendation, one question. First is a recommendation of Karl Ove Nausgaard, who is, of course, I think over the last 5 years or so, has become really quite the name mm-hmm. in terms of nonfiction, in terms of being a memoirist.
Yes.
And I've heard this name come up over and over again. I've not actually read
I've
any.
I've not read him either. So yeah, good one over there to sort of check out, I think.
Mm, and I think a good one for a book club too.
Yes.
So yes. Also, what are your thoughts on translated literary works? So I don't think that we have the time to actually get into that because I have a lot of thoughts.
I think we need to do a show on that.
Mm, because obviously translations, so much of the power rests in the hands of the translator. There's a reason why, good ones are so highly sought mm-hmm. after. And I always wonder whether I'm missing something. Yeah.
So we do love recommendations. And one of the shows we did that got a lot of recommendations, actually, was the one we did on reading outside of our comfort zone, where we had Cam Ruslan join us. Some of the suggestions we got for us to read was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Melissa Thien sent that in. And Sandra emailed in, and she said that we should get Cam to read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, because he usually only reads historical nonfiction.
So, just a little teaser, we are in fact getting Cam to read that book. So we promised at the time when we did that show about reading out of your comfort zone that we would all recommend books to each other, or rather Cam would recommend for both of us, yes. We would recommend for him, books that do sit outside. I'm happy to say that book exchange has indeed taken place. So that episode is going to be coming your way pretty soon, it's sometime early 2020. Let's just give ourselves some time to read and digest, but that will be coming your way soon. So do continue to write to us. I wish we were a little more timely with our responses. We need to be better correspondents.
But we're kind of analog corresponding here.
We are. So do get in touch if you have book recommendations, if you have any thoughts you'd like to share about what you're reading right now. Always love hearing about that. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, and of course, write to us by the book at bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.